get started. My name is Peter Lundholm. I'm a chaplain at Memorial Hospital in Cambridge, Minnesota, and I'm going to be talking with you this morning about identifying our addictions. Before I get into that, I want to do some plugging of some books from the bookstore. I think this particular book is a real valuable one. It's Addiction and Grace by Gerald May. And Gerald May is a psychiatrist, but also somebody who has worked with spirituality over the years. And it's a very informative and, I think, powerful book. Unfortunately, it is a bit expensive. I noticed there are some copies in the bookstore. And I also know that they're going to be coming out with paperback later this summer. Mm-hmm. So this would be a good one to pick up. Another one that's in the bookstore, and this is for men. This is a relatively new book in the last year, Catching Fire, Men Coming Alive in Recovery. It's by Merle Fossum. And I think for men who are interested in recovery, this is also a real useful book. And then lastly, one that's not in the bookstore, and I didn't know I was coming here until fairly recently, so I didn't have time really to identify something that I would like to see on the bookshelves here. But this is another, I think, a useful one, somewhat simpler than the other two books, but really a real basic kind of book on addiction to help us understand addiction and particularly our own addictions, to help us use use the 12-step process even for those of us who are not formally diagnosed as chemically dependent. It's a real useful, I think, work. Let Go, Let God by John Keller. Surrendering Self-Centered Delusions in the Costly Journey of Faith.
How old a book is that, Peter? Would be in most libraries, you think?
I think it would be in many libraries. It's from Augsburg. It's 1985 copyright.
No copyright on titles, apparently, because 30 years ago there was a book by an Englishman, Albert Cliff, Let Go, Let God.
Okay. Identifying our own addictions. I think it's important. Hopefully what I told you last night or what I talked about last night would help you have the sense that much of the way that the church has responded to people who are chemically dependent has been in a fairly moralistic pattern. I think that's unfortunate. I think much of the way that our society has responded to chemically dependent people is in terms of a kind of a moralistic, judgmental stand. And that, too, is unfortunate. I want to say that's been a part of my own family experience as well. One of the things that's been interesting for me has been that the hospital that I serve in which I'm chaplain, is 15 miles down the road from a little town called Braham, Minnesota, where my grandfather was pastor in the 1930s. I was reading the history of that congregation. They published a nice centennial history of that congregation. And in there, one of the things I found about my grandfather was that he had been very much involved in the Anti-Saloon League. Mm-hmm. And it was important enough that they mentioned that in their centennial history, that this was one of the things that they remembered about this pastor who was there, that he had been involved in the Anti-Saloon League. Interesting, too, that his oldest son, my dad's oldest brother, was alcoholic and ultimately died of his alcoholism. I bring this up because while I regret the kind of moralism that's been a part of our history and our tradition, I do believe that it is an indication of concern. You know, at its basic level, these people were not indifferent to chemically dependent people in their congregations, in their midst. And while there may have been a moralistic attitude toward it, I think that's sometimes understandable. After all, we could look at an addicted person and look at their behavior. And I think the most obvious thing for most of us would be to say, well, let's take the chemical away. Let's remove that substance that is producing this harmful behavior. Doesn't really say anything at all about the orientation of the person who is chemically dependent. And we could do that. You know, we've done that. We've tried to do that. Prohibition, the temperance movement, were all ways of trying to remove that what looked to be the problem. We can identify that this chemical is creating the problem, so we try to remove it. And I understand that, and I appreciate that there was a concern for chemically dependent people in that. But I want to suggest, as I did briefly last night, that there are some alternatives to that kind of response to chemically dependent people. And I believe that one of the things that we could respond from, or a way that we could respond, is to respond in the way that our Lord did to various people that he encountered. He identified with them. And I want to suggest that we identify with chemically dependent people, that we can learn something from them. And in identifying with them, we need to identify our own addictions, our own compulsive tendencies, and the kinds of powers that are a part of that addictive process. I want to comment just a bit more about the kind of moralism that we have seen as a response. And this is quoting from John Keller in Let Go and Let God. The words God, Jesus, Christian Church, religion, sin, and belief are filled with moralistic perceptions and content in many people's lives inside and outside the church, just as they were for the early members of AA. Yet the gospel teaches that God revealed in Christ is not the great moralist. However, because the Christian church is made up of humans, and we all have moralism embedded within us, the perception and communication of the gospel's message of God's love toward us have often been distorted and contaminated with moralism. And then a brief discussion of the parable of the prodigal son. Jesus' story about the son who leaves his father's home, squanders his life and inheritance, and then returns is an interesting one in terms of moralism. It is identified as the story of the prodigal son. Perhaps most of us in the church are more like the moralistic son, remaining in the father's house, than the prodigal son who left and returned. The son who remained with his father in his father's house never really knew his father. He had projected his moralism onto his image of his father. So when the non-moralistic father welcomed his brother back with open arms, with a banquet and a celebration, the son who had remained in his father's house was confused, disillusioned, and angry. So I suggest that part of our task, then, is to identify with the chemically dependent person, and in so doing, identifying our own addictions. That is not to say that we tolerate alcoholic or addictive behavior, but that we identify with those who are chemically dependent. Well, if that's true, then what is addiction? Or maybe better than that, why does addiction happen? And I want to suggest several things here. Number one, the World Health Organization defines addiction as a pathological relationship to a substance, event, or experience. That's one way to look at addiction. A pathological relationship to a substance, event, or experience. The other quote that I want to share with you is from one of our patients. And I mentioned it last night. He talked about being an addictive person. He said, "I am an addictive person. I find something that feels good and I do it until it hurts." Mm-hmm. That's a very simple, I think, way of stating what the issue is. So why do people get into addiction? Let's see, we got a clock or a
on the board.
Okay. One of the basic principles in addiction is that the chemicals, the substance, the event, or the experience alters how we feel. It changes our feelings. And so if we have feelings which are not comfortable for us, we may choose, by use of the chemicals, to change those feelings. That's a real common experience for people who are chemically dependent. And as I look at my own compulsive tendencies, I do that as well. For one thing, I found that in commuting back and forth to work, I commute a distance of 50 miles. And so at the end of a long day, I have a fairly long commute. And I'm tired. One of the things that food does for me is that it stimulates me. It's a stimulant. So I may be feeling tired, may be feeling sleepy, as a matter of fact, but if I have a little something to nibble on, it keeps me awake so that I can get home safely. I quit drinking coffee about 3 years ago, and so I don't rely on that particular stimulant anymore. But I still find that as I use food, it changes my feeling, it changes my mood. Maybe not perhaps as dramatically as, say, alcohol or cocaine or some other kind of substance would do, but it changes how I feel. Use of chemicals, use of a mood-altering substance can be a way of distracting ourselves from uncomfortable situations or experiences. I think of an example of where somebody might do some hard physical kind of work following a very painful kind of an experience. And that work, getting lost in one's work, is a way to distract oneself mm-hmm. from that kind of painful and uncomfortable experience.
Peter?
Yeah.
But isn't the difference, though, that becomes compulsive? Because that can also be a very healthy thing for
sure.
People going through tremendous work
right.
or something.
Yeah. And there is a learning process that happens in this, where it eventually crosses over to where one has to ultimately use the substance in order to feel normal.
Mm-hmm.
We all feel, I think, most of our lives, some levels of anxiety. And so we may use compulsive behaviors to manage that kind of anxiety. One thing that compulsive behavior does is that it binds anxiety. And as we talk about families, there is a kind of a natural level of anxiety within any family. Could kind of use an analogy from physics and say that there is a kind of a field effect. So that there is within a family, a kind of any given family or any given set of relationships, a kind of a field of anxiety that may be greater or lesser depending on what's going on in that family. And the compulsive behavior can be a way of binding that anxiety, controlling it. We look at for instance, we no longer in our treatment center have smoking within the treatment facility itself. Back all five years ago even, if you sat in on a treatment group, you know, a big ring of people sitting around drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes. Mm-hmm. Naturally, for those people going through treatment, there was a real high level of anxiety. And having that cigarette available was a way of controlling some of that, of altering that that feeling, of managing that. Okay. So that's some sense of then of the power or of the way that chemicals or compulsive behavior even begins to impact the way we feel, how it gets started. I'm wondering how many of you are familiar with step one from the 12 steps. Does anybody know what that is? Yeah.
Admitting that we are powerless over whatever it is, mm-hmm. the alcohol or the event, and that, well, that's it, just admitting that we're powerless.
Yeah, that our lives had become unmanageable. I don't think that we can really begin to identify the addictions very thoroughly until we can kind of do some step one work for ourselves. We have to look at the way that our compulsive behavior operates and how it complicates our lives. But I want to have you take a look at a chart of addictions. This is from Gerald May's book. And he has divided this into two sections. He has attraction addictions. Maybe I want to move this mic over a little bit here. He has attraction addictions and aversion addictions. And I'm wondering, looking at that attraction addictions list, whether you could identify some things that you behave compulsively with. People in the back row having a little trouble seeing. Yeah. Can you feel free to come up a little closer?
Can you read a few of them?
Okay. Anger, approval, art, attractiveness, being good, being helpful, being loved, being nice, being right, being taken care of, calendars, candy, cars, causes, chewing gum, children, chocolate, cleanliness, coffee, comparisons, competence, competition, computers, contests, death, depression, dreams, drinking, drugs, eating, envy, exercise, so on and so forth. You pick out something that you are compulsively attracted to. Maybe a way to ask this question would be, what would you miss if you didn't have it? Okay?
Mm-hmm. You know what, if you move the machine a little closer, will it be bigger?
No, I think that'll make it smaller.
Okay.
Maybe I should move it back.
Yes.
Okay, we'll try that. Okay.
Yeah,
good.
Okay.
Well, we're not going to admit being attracted to such things as anger or envy.
You could admit being attracted.
No, I say we would not.
That wouldn't be something, yeah. But some people are. Some people would mood alter by means of their anger. That's one of the phenomenons that happen, or one of the phenomena that happens in abusive families, where somebody has a rage addiction. That adrenaline rush that comes when they're feeling rageful is a very addictive kind of an experience.
And you can't be helped until you admit this, right?
Mm-hmm. Do they use it to get their way? Is that the point?
That's a part of it, sure. You know, I think most of us would rather feel powerful rather than powerless. And that's the paradox in step one, admitting we are powerless over alcohol or whatever, and that our lives have become unmanageable. Because until we can make that kind of an admission, we're not going to be able to deal with this. And one of the things about addiction is that it takes away human freedom. The compulsion really denies human freedom. I know that many women's groups have a real issue with step one as a part of the 12-step process. You know, we've heard powerlessness. We've experienced that in our lives. We don't need any more of that. And yet, paradoxically, until one looks at one's situation, one's limits as a human being, we really don't have freedom.
Dreams be an addiction?
I think in the sense of fantasy, of being just absorbed by that dreaming. Having those dreams have a kind of power over us. I think of some people, for instance, who get into the kind of dream analysis that's sometimes a part of some psychological kinds of treatment, and a real beneficial thing in some cases, but can really get into kind of an addictive relationship with that dreaming, to where they're involved in that, preoccupied with that, and really don't function well in the rest of their life because of that kind of preoccupation and addiction.
It can be the other way too.
Sure. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that this points up is that any particular addictive substance could, or experience or event, could have positive qualities. That's not to say that that's true. But it's the addictive or compulsivity that's within each of us, I think, that has the potential to transform these into life-denying kinds of experiences.
Are there certain foods that are listed separately there, do they have any special, are they more addictive than other foods, or why are certain ones listed? Just for example.
I think primarily for example. But I also know one of the things that I've done recently is I've started going to an OA group. An OA group, an Overeaters Anonymous group. Because that's an area of compulsion for me. And one of the things that I've learned from them is that there are, for some of us, some kinds of binge foods that we go towards, you know? For me, it happens to be chips and dip, you know? And pizza, things like that.
Ice cream.
Okay, ice cream is for some other people.
Chocolate.
Sure.
That goes from craving a sweet or salty.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I thought it was interesting here just a couple weeks ago that both, and I didn't know this, that both sugar and salt change your adrenal. You get a
surge,
yeah, physiological change.
Sure. Okay, so there is a physiological part of this. Okay, let's look at aversion addictions here. What might we compulsively avoid?
Anchovies?
What would be some of your, the kinds of things you compulsively avoid?
Is that more like a phobia?
Sure, but it is a compulsion as well.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay. Could you read through a few of those?
Okay. Airplanes, anchovies, anger, animals, being abnormal, being alone, being discounted, being fat, being judged, being overwhelmed, being thin, being tricked, birds, blood, boredom, bridges, bugs, cats, closed in spaces, commitment, conflict, prowess, darkness, death, dentists, dependence, dirt, disapproval, and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Now, what do you call these?
These are aversion addictions.
They're not so bad, huh?
No, I don't think that's true at all. I think that they're just as compulsive and they're just as destructive of human freedom.
Well, then, for instance, I don't like to stand in line at a cafeteria or a buffet. I figure if I'm paying for a meal, I ought to get it promptly, even though if you sit down, you wait longer. Would you call that an aversion? If I go into a place and there's a long line, I say, let's go someplace else.
Could be, you know. And it depends on how that impacts your life.
Well, we laugh about it.
Mm-hmm. So maybe it isn't a major kind of an addiction for you. It hasn't had major consequences in your life. I would guess that a similar kind of impatience with some other kinds of situations might be very damaging.
But it can impact those with him.
Okay. Exactly.
Yeah.
Sure can.
Sure, I may want to stand in line and he leaves me.
It's not that bad.
We just leave him home.
All right, I'm sorry.
And that may be, I think that's very helpful. Because it does impact others. It does damage relationships that are valuable to us, or potentially, you know. And maybe you have learned to live with this and to laugh about it. And that's great. But there would be other kinds of aversion addictions that would be very painful and very difficult to live with.
I think the one to vulnerability, which people have trouble understanding, is if they see how if you were in the aversion to vulnerability, it would destroy your whole.
Sure. How would you have relationships if you needed to avoid at all costs any kind of vulnerability? Very difficult. Mm-hmm. Next to impossible.
Right.
Okay. Vulnerable to criticism.
Sure. Avoiding criticism, avoiding situations where you could be criticized.
Yeah.
What would you cheat yourself out of in terms of your life experience, if that were true?
Trying anything new.
Mm-hmm. We couldn't afford to make mistakes. It's a very painful kind of an experience. So I say again, what would be some of your other addictions as you see them? Either things that you are attracted to or things that you avoid.
Well, how about if you can handle it another way? For instance, I don't like elevators, but I can always walk up the stairs. Okay?
Yeah. There I would say, again, you know, the kinds of consequences that you experience.
Yeah.
Are there some places that you would really like to go in your life that are accessible only by elevator?
There might be.
Might be.
I could definitely identify with the one on calendars. part of my culture shock of going back to Holden Village is either not needing or trying to get away from it. My life run by a calendar.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm writing everything down and always glancing in to see what's next.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you carry a little date book around with you?
I don't, but I mean, when I'm back in school, I carry a calendar with me.
Yeah. And if you were to suddenly misplace that or lose it, what would that feel like?
Panic.
Right.
I get a couple of feelings like having power, like I'm a foreman on jobs and stuff, and I don't like doing that. I don't like telling people what to do. But you know, that situation I get into a lot, but yet I don't like the feeling brings up.
And so that avoiding some of that is maybe kind of compulsive for you.
Yeah, but you got the job because you were capable, so you have to do this.
That's why I don't take when they ask me, I don't take it anymore.
Sure. You know that it's a setup for you in terms of your own well-being.
So what happened when I came here? I'd been here about 2 days and all the rest of the carpenters left and I was here. God gives you the same lesson until you learn it. Then you get it. Right, that was pretty funny.
An alternate might be to try to develop some kind of a team feeling between other people that you have to sort of direct, maybe.
Sure.
Yeah.
It'd be a different way of handling it.
I have a real problem with confrontations. And I don't seem to get any better at it. I mean, everyone I have that's serious, I remember so long, and I think, why do I remember all the details that are uncomfortable. And it sort of stays with me, and I don't seem to grow. That I try to avoid them if possible. And then that just sort of simmers all the time, you know, until you do something about it. One of the things I learned here about, you better face up to them and just face it.
Sure. Because if you don't, if you continue the avoiding that, or the aversion to that, it just continues to perpetuates the problem. It gets worse. That's one of the characteristics of addictive behavior, by the way. It is that it is progressive, and that it is chronic. It doesn't just go away if we leave it alone, or we try to ignore it. It's progressive and chronic, and in the case of chemical addiction, particularly, ultimately death is the result of the disease. Fatal. Progressive in the sense that unless something is done with it, unless we get into a recovery program, it gets worse. Unless we do something with it, it gets worse. Chronic in the sense that it doesn't just go away by itself, and ultimately fatal. You mentioned my uncle died before I was born, never knew the man, but he died as a result of his alcoholism. And we think about things like, again, like overeating. People die of that kind of compulsive behavior. Heart attacks, all kinds of health problems that are part of that. And it is progressive, chronic, and fatal. Okay, I want to do something in terms of looking at the way the disease affects us spiritually. Our compulsivity affects us spiritually. And see if you can identify some of this happening for yourself. One of the things that we know about chemical dependency, about addiction, is that there are some things that are kind of core assumptions. And they're common to not only chemically dependent people, but I think all people. And that is that there is within each of us a kind of egocentric, omnipotent self. Some people might call that original sin. But it's true, I believe, of each and every one of us as human beings. And there are three assumptions that go with this. This is again from Keller's little book. I am in control, or ought to be in control, of all that has to do with my life. Okay, assumption number one. Number two, I am at the center of the universe. Pretty egocentric. Number three, everything and everyone ought to be spinning around me, so I can have what I want and life will be the way I want it to be. Inner kinds of assumptions. Some things, some of those we're not conscious of as a part of our compulsive behavior. I think most of us are not conscious of that kind of assumption that operates within each of us. But important to take a look at. And if we take a look at alcoholic behavior, there are various things that kind of arise out of those assumptions. There's a lot of rationalizing. There's a lot of denial. And there is a lot of blame. But then we can take a look at ourselves as well and see that we also have that kind of process. We do a lot of rationalizing and a lot of denial and a lot of blaming. And just because we take the chemicals out of our lives, we stop some kind of compulsive behavior, doesn't mean that we don't continue to have those kinds of issues. And so there is an addictive process that operates within us, whether we are chemical-free or not, whether we change our compulsive behavior or not. I want to do kind of a description of the way that this can affect us in terms of our spirituality. One of the things that people will often hear when they are in treatment programs is that they will hear a description of the kinds of physiological and emotional symptoms of the disease. And that's what's called a Jelinek chart or Jelinek lecture, where it describes the kinds of physical symptoms that go with chemical dependency, or the emotional, psychological symptoms. And those would include things like blackouts, increased tolerance, decreased tolerance. There are a number of different kinds of symptomatic characteristics. I would argue, and a number of other people argue, that there is a like or similar spiritual progression with chemical dependency, and I think with compulsivity in our lives. So looking at our own addictions, it becomes, I think, important and useful to take a look at the way our compulsivity then affects our lives. First of all, sedating our values. And next in progression is a persistent violation of values. Low sense of self-worth. When we persistently violate our own values, one of the things that we do is erode our sense of who we are, our identity as human beings, our relationship. Dan was talking this morning, just briefly, about the way that the Israelites had periodically fallen away from the covenant community, and how there was a kind of progressive injustice that developed, and idolatry that went with that. And I think, as you talked about that, Dan, there was a loss of a sense of who they were, and a loss of a relationship then to Yahweh as well. And that's similar, very similar to this. Yeah.
Yeah, is that also related? At one time, it was said with such surety that a person becomes addicted because of low self-esteem. And is that maybe changing to say because you are addicted, you lose your self-esteem rather than...
I don't buy the notion that one becomes addicted because of low self-esteem. I don't think that there is a kind of cause and effect relationship. Certainly, you know, medicating one's feelings or getting involved in some other kind of compulsive or addictive behavior is a way of countering feelings of low self-esteem. But I think at the core of those low self-esteem feelings is the kind of thing that I was reading from Keller, that omnipotent egocentric self who is not satisfied with the way things are. You know, certainly, like I said, medicating feelings would be a way of dealing with that low self-esteem. But also, the progression of the disease contributes, I think, in large measure to the loss of self-esteem. Loss of identity, loss of relationship. When we begin, when that low self-esteem really is eroded, or that self-esteem is eroded, one of the things that happens then is we develop increasing defenses. And that isolates us. And there is increasing dishonesty. I neglected to bring down today one of the other books that I think is real helpful. There's a new book out in the last couple of years called To Thine Own Self Be True. It's by Lewis Andrews, a psychologist. He's talking about ethics as a kind of therapy. And one of the things that he comments in that book is the experience of lying. How that clouded his vision, how it increased his pulse rate, his very sense of well-being as a person was affected by those lies, by the kind of manipulative behavior that he was indulging in. And he goes on to say that that lying, the dishonesty, is a form of spiritual suicide. And I really believe that that's true. I think you can probably have a sense of how the developing of the defenses really separates you from other people, makes you much less trustful. After all, you have to protect that low or eroded sense of self-esteem, and so you develop greater and greater defenses, ways of manipulating, rationalizing, defending yourself from that very painful experience of loss of yourself. And there's a projection and blame are a part of that. I think that's one of the things that very often causes people who are chemically dependent to have a good deal of trouble with the whole experience of church and of God. It's very easy out of that painful experience to project and blame, and who after all, when that egocentric self is experiencing this pain and difficulty, would be easier to project blame upon, you know, than the ultimate authority in one's life, the ultimate power. And so that really enters, I think, into the lives of a lot of people who experience chemical dependency. And we blame God for our painful experiences. There's a lot of cynicism, and there is despair, and ultimately death. Suicide often. It's one of the common ways that chemically dependent people lose their life. And that, not to leave you with this, but I think that in one sense the reversal of that process is what recovery is then about. So that we begin by you know, there is a step one, an experience of powerlessness, and there is beginning glimpse of hope as one experiences a 12-step group, begins to have contact with other human beings who have gone through what we have gone through, who have had similar kinds of experiences, who can identify with us and not judge us. And so that begins a road to recovery. Breaking that isolation, beginning to take accountability or responsibility for one's behavior and one's actions rather than blaming other people. Beginning to look at the kinds of pain one experiences, or at least some of the kind of pain that is a part of the addictive experience, and making the connection between the use of that compulsive, that chemical or that compulsive behavior, and taking responsibility for that. One final kind of drawing that I want to do, or illustration, picture.
Peter, there may be more ink in that orange or red.
Okay.
Thanks,
thank you.
Yeah, thanks,
Dan. Try the orange ones.
Harder to read.
Is this?
Yeah. Okay. Try the orange one. The orange one's real bright.
You're too delicate. I'm all black.
No. This up here just to help us get a sense of the distinction between the disease and the recovery. With the disease, there is a physical compulsion, and I think for things like alcohol or other kinds of chemical substances, that's easy to have a sense of what that might be about, a physical craving to that substance. Or perhaps within, in terms of the aversion addiction, you know, a physical repulsion, a mental obsession, a lot of preoccupation, thinking our thought processes revolve around that experience or that substance. And as the disease progresses, that becomes increasingly true. And finally, a self-centeredness that really affects our spiritual lives. The end result of the addiction, or the end stage of the addiction, really is the point at which one is genuinely unable to care for oneself or anybody else. It is a kind of, as theologians would say, a state where one is curved in on oneself. It is that kind of self-centeredness that is the end state of the addiction. The recovery then involves abstinence. Whatever compulsive relationship, abstinence from that thing, or abstinence from that behavior,
mental freedom, no longer the kinds of preoccupation that one might have beforehand, and a spiritual centeredness. I would also say that that involves a kind of self-awareness. Rather than a self-preoccupation. And so, I wanted to make that point. I was thinking that some last night during the panel discussion, that people that I know who are really actively involved in a recovery program, it is not a self-centered kind of experience. There is a self-awareness, not a self-preoccupation, not a navel-gazing. And it is an expanded kind of awareness of themselves and of their relationship to other human beings and the whole creation. Some of the most powerful spirituality that I'm aware of in terms of creation spirituality is a kind of spirituality that I hear from chemically dependent people who are recovering, who really find in nature and creation a nourishment for their spirit and an awareness of a power greater than themselves. Well, I will throw this open to discussion and questions.
Is this does this seem to affect introverted people more so than the extroverted?
I don't think so.
Yeah. Extroversion and some of the behaviors associated with it can themselves be compulsive.
Mm-hmm. Or introversion can be compulsive. Yeah.
A couple of things I was thinking about in the recovery part here. I got really obsessed with buying stuff, you know, and I got a feel like a real need, the same feeling I used to get when it was time to get loaded, you know, when I had money and it was time to go shopping, you know. And there's a friend of mine that he got really powerless over diamond earrings for a long time. You know, he was out of trouble because he was always buying these diamond earrings to be okay. And, you know, like you said, you clean up a horse depot, you got some clean horse depot. You know, there's a lot of stuff.
Yeah. I think shopping is a major compulsion.
Sure.
Well, food offering.
Yeah. I have a lot of friends go shopping.
Sure, it won't last long, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there is a bottoming out with that, too. Mm-hmm. Spendaholics. Mm-hmm. Just as crazy compulsive behavior with that as there is with chemicals.
There's what a group for them now, is there too?
I think so.
Peter?
Yeah.
You said at the beginning that withdrawal of the chemical was not always the best thing to do. Now, do you know the program called Intervention?
I know what Intervention is.
Yeah. That is total withdrawal at once, you know, with no...
Well, not necessarily. If you're referring to the same thing I'm thinking of, intervention is a process of a way, as a way of getting people help, you know, of intervening in the progression. I took the chart, intervening in the progression of the disease before it becomes fatal. One of the options for somebody that has had an intervention would be for them to go to through experience of detoxification, where they would be gradually have the chemical removed.
Well, this happened to my sister, who had become dependent upon prescription drugs,
mm-hmm.
Valium and mm-hmm. sleeping pills and so on, following a very severe illness. So her sons put her into an intervention program, total mm-hmm. withdrawal in 6 weeks and so on, but she came out, she never really had accepted it.
Right.
She had been taken off, detoxified.
Sure.
And she was kept clean from then on.
Yeah.
But she never had gone into real recovery.
Exactly. One can, you know, one can continue that kind of egocentric behavior.
Uh-huh. I always crave them.
Mm-hmm. And what a heck of a way to live.
Yeah, it was terrible.
Wouldn't wish that on anybody.
No, because she lost her total freedom,
mm-hmm.
her life. and died.
Yeah. Well, I thank you for your attention.
Well, we thank you.
Thank you.
I'm satisfied.